Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's real food advocate Michael Pollan and the real question behind the local, sustainable, and organic way of life. Can we afford it? That's the dilemma for the man who penned The Omnivore's Dilemma. While the Stearns expound on the high art of the New Mexican green chili cheeseburger, we've got a Facebook take on free food, the LA gang of artistic foragers who map out fallen fruit. Then it's the hotbed of the great American potato chip, a.k.a. chips worth a road trip. And star chefs take on the lunch truck. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Today we talk with Michael Pollan, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma and In Defense of Food. I ask him the question of our time. How can the ideal of local, organic, and sustainable be sustainable if only a few can afford it? You know those fruit trees you see around town with all that ripe goodness going to waste? Well, a group of LA artists is doing something about it. Did you know that there is a potato chip region in the United States? I mean, just like barbecue country? Well, we get a personal tour of the old-time chipsters from the author of Crunch, A History of the Great American Potato Chip. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's get rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, we're going to do one of our roundups rather than talk about a particular place. The subject of the roundup is green chili cheeseburgers, and the place is New Mexico.
You know, Lynn, that the state vegetable of New Mexico, or actually the state co-vegetable of New Mexico, is the chili pepper along with the pinto bean.
Mm-hmm.
And as you well know, New Mexico really takes chili seriously, so much so that they spell it differently than every other place. They put an E at the end of it instead of an I. And one of the great inventions of New Mexico, and we believe we've actually found, well, we found two places that claim to have invented it, is the green chili cheeseburger, which is, as it sounds, a hamburger with cheese, but also with chopped or sliced green chilies on top, roasted ones, of course. And two places claim to have invented it. One is the Owl Bar in San Antonio, New Mexico, not far from where they used to test atom bombs about a half century ago. It is said that the nuclear scientists used to go there after testing the A-bombs, and they wanted something kind of explosive for supper. So they invented the green chili cheeseburger.
That glowed in the dark.
Right? Right.
Well, you might glow in the dark after eating one. The other place that claims to have invented it is in Santa Fe, New Mexico. It's a charming little drive-in called Bert's Burger Bowl. The chilies there are especially kind of roasty and toasty and really add something special to the creamy flavor of the cheese and the kind of gnarled burger that they top.
You know, I don't think you know what green chili is until you go to New Mexico. What do you guys think?
You're absolutely right, because, you know, in New Mexico, the chilies there really have a vegetable flavor. I mean, they have that flavor that I've described as kind of, it's like sunshine. I mean, it has less to do with the heat, because some of these are fairly hot, but it's not just hot. It's that intense green vegetable verdant flavor that no other vegetable has.
Have you been to Hatch, New Mexico, Lynn?
You know, I've never actually gotten down there, but that's the big chili center.
Exactly. And there are these big open roasters that are sort of hand cranked by the side of the road, and they roast the chilies. When the chili is done, you get it on a slab of French bread, and that's the sandwich. It's just an incredibly delicious, freshly roasted red or green pepper, and it's the best thing you've ever had.
I know when you go to Santa Fe in that area of northern New Mexico in September, there's this smell in the air because they're roasting the chilies sometimes over open fire or coals, and people just buy them by the ton and then they freeze them and you know they just keep them all winter. But going back to the cheeseburger, would it be a mortal sin to put ketchup on a green chili cheeseburger?
Well, you know how much I hate ketchup in general, so it's a mortal sin
to even say the word
for ketchup
in front of
Jane. To even exist. But moving right along, you know, honestly, and this is not just because I'm a ketchup hater. I was thinking the other day that two things that never work together are tomatoes and chilies. I mean, I've never had. Except maybe in some spaghetti sauce, but New Mexican chilies and tomatoes just don't marry well.
That's going to be a big shock to most Texans, I have to tell you.
Well, Texans, New Mexico is a big shock to Texans in general. I mean, it is, you know, the Civil War number, you know, part two.
Yeah.
Because anything they do in Texas, they hate it in New Mexico and vice versa.
And frankly, I've never had any condiment on a green chili cheeseburger except sometimes lettuce and, I have to say, Jane, slices of tomato. I think ketchup, the texture of ketchup would completely contradict that kind of the firmness. I mean, because these roasted peppers are not mushy. You know, they have a kind of al dente quality to them that the mushiness of ketchup would overwhelm.
I have one quick other thing we have to mention, and that's Bobcat Bite.
Oh, one of the great restaurants anywhere. I mean, this is outside of Santa Fe, and they have a stupendously good green chili cheeseburger, but the place itself is just like, it's like out of a film noir in the 1940s, the neon sign that says Bobcat Bite. Inside, it's like an old-fashioned diner. The name, in fact, comes from the fact that there used to be bobcats up in the hills around it. And this is the place to get one of the great green chili cheeseburgers
anywhere.
And you
know what? I'm humbled because I just remember they put tomato slices on their chili cheeseburger.
Shame on you, Jane.
You see, but not Jane, ketchup.
Hey, guys, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
I say tomato.
Jane and Michael Stern are authors of 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Now, you know the Sterns are here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. You know where. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to check out all of our other great opportunities. Our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to make your worknight cooking easier with a new recipe each week, along with tips, deathless pros, and assorted discoveries. Find that and much more at splendidtable.org. So I found this Facebook entry from a group of artists in L.A. Now, from what I could see, they do art installations, they feed the homeless, and they call themselves Fallen Fruit. David Burns, who's one of the three people who created Fallen Fruit, is on the phone. David, welcome.
Thank you.
So what's Fallen Fruit about?
Fallen Fruit is a project that I've worked with my two collaborators, Austin Young and Matthias Wiegner, for the past 5 years. And what we started with was looking at the neighborhood in which we live, which is a neighborhood in Los Angeles. And we mapped all of the fruit trees that exist in public space. So all of the predominantly organic, natural, ripe fruit that is available for the public and exists within the public domain.
I think people are really hesitant to pick that.
It's actually true. I mean, that's changed, at least on the east side of Los Angeles. There's you know, there's not that much public fruit at this point. You kind of have to look. But we have we started doing public fruit tours, or we call them nocturnal fruit forages. So we go out at dusk, so people are actually home, right?
Right,
in their
exactly.
neighborhoods, and we bring flashlights and shopping carts, and we do a tour of the neighborhood, and we talk about the political issues about neighborhood space, and then we also talk about identifying fruit trees and thinking about local grown and things like that.
And this, the goal here is to use this fruit so that we're not, it's not going to waste, and people don't necessarily have to spend the money to buy their fruit?
Well, that's definitely one part of the goal. The other part is to think about where you live and the relationships that you have with the people around you.
I'm just picturing people coming down my block with shopping carts and flashlights. I would either call the police or say, come on in for a coffee.
No, well, typically, actually what happens is, I mean, we've had up to over 100 people with us, and we don't know the people. They just they show up from internet postings, et cetera. And always somebody invites us into the backyard to pick the plum tree and the peach tree. Please take more because we can't use this. And so you're right. I mean, part of what we do is thinking about, well, you know, where did this banana come from? Well, it came from 1,500 miles away, picked from people you'll never meet, and they show up in your grocery store every day, almost ripe and without fail.
Right? And they cost money.
And they cost a certain amount of money, yeah.
Now, there's an art connection to this, right?
Absolutely.
What's the art connection?
Well, we do a part of the project we could call sort of social or public, you know, activism, right? And then the other stuff that we do is we create videos and photographs and installation projects that get exhibited in museums and art galleries. So we interact in the public realm in a few different ways.
So if I want to have a directory to where I can find some fruit trees, I just go online and find your site? And is this spreading to other cities?
Yeah, that's a great question. We make a map for everywhere that we get invited to go. So we've mapped a few different cities in the world. Most of the maps are for Los Angeles, our hometown. But what's happened over the past 5 years is that people in other communities have heard about the project and map their own neighborhoods or create their own community system of distribution. Oakland in California is one of the most amazing areas. There's a project called Forage Oakland that actually goes through neighborhoods by people volunteering their trees, and people go pick them and redistribute them for free. Which is completely amazing. We don't take that on because we think that's a little too much for what we want to accomplish. But it definitely happens in other cities. I mean, there's no doubt. Minnesota and Connecticut and Florida and all over the place, yeah.
It's got a lot of stuff here to check out. It sounds like it's a great idea. Hey, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much.
David Burns is one of the three Los Angeles artists who created Fallen Fruit. Now, you can get more information on Fallen Fruit and where to forage on the website, splendidtable.org. You know, this whole idea of not letting public food plants go to waste, or maybe planting that extra tomato plant or peach tree on the edge of your property so that passersby can help themselves, well, that goes back to before biblical times. It's called gleaning. There's even an entry in the Old Testament that instructs farmers not to harvest the edges of their fields so that strangers and the poor won't go hungry. Well, if you're lucky enough to glean some fruit, I've got some techniques to help you make the most of it. Now, when you cook your fruit, cook it all the way. Fruit is best either raw or cooked so that its sugars concentrate. If it stays in between, it's kind of flat and tasteless. Perfect grilled fruit by coating it with sugar or fat so that it browns gorgeously. Now, with fruit tarts and pies, sidestep soggy bottoms by pre-baking the bottom crust. Now, the one caveat here is that if you've got fruit pieces spread out on the crust so they barely touch, you can skip the pre-bake. So test drive this technique with my simple recipe for summer fruit pizza with rosemary and basil. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, Michael Pollan on the real omnivore's dilemma and the renaissance of the great American potato chip. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Just Bare Chicken, all natural with no antibiotics, vegetable fed, cage free, traceable to the family farm where raised. Just Bare Chicken. Go minimal. You can learn more at justbarechicken.com. I wonder if we Americans have ever been as concerned about our food as we are now. I mean, for many, the first concern is having enough food. Now, only when that's solved do you get to move on to the more luxurious questions about how and where it was raised, who grew it, and health issues. Well, one book about these questions by one man captured America's collective attention. It's The Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan. Now, Michael's written extensively about how we eat. His latest book is In Defense of Food, an Eater's Manifesto. Michael, welcome.
Good to be here, Lynn.
So I'm thinking about you've got Omnivore's Dilemma and you have In Defense of Food. And both books talk so much about local, organic, where our food comes from, what the ideal is in terms of the choices we should make. But how is that playing today in the economy that we're living with?
Well, people are really strapped, and you're right to suggest that organic and local food costs more generally than processed food, mm-hmm. supermarket food. And so I think it's going to be a challenge for people to eat this way. But I've been very curious to see that the farmers markets, and I've been asking as I've gone around the, around the country, are still doing as well as last year. They have not been hurt. All the people I've talked to involved with farmers markets. And the people, even though Whole Foods, I know, is really suffering, the people who sell them food, like Stonyfield Farm and Applegate, I've talked to the people there, and they're still doing very well. So at least a certain number of Americans are still digging down deep and still willing to pay for a superior product. On the other hand, there are some contradictory trends. McDonald's is doing great. They're thriving. People are trading down from better restaurants to McDonald's. That's not anything to be thrilled about.
Yeah, not a surprise either.
It's not a surprise at all. Look, you can get a lot of calories there for a couple bucks.
Right.
And in hard times, that counts for a lot. But another trend that I think is very encouraging is that ingredient sales in supermarkets are up, which tells us that people are cooking more. And that is one way to deal with the fact that food is expensive and people have less money. So people who might have been going out to eat, some of them are going to McDonald's and some of them are staying home and cooking.
You know, I have an argument that says if it's not affordable across the economic scale in this country for people who make, you know, far less than those people who are generally shopping in, you know, the upscale supermarkets or even the farmers markets. If it's not affordable to that end of the population as well as the rest of the population, then the concept isn't sustainable.
Well, yeah, but you have to look, you know, are you thinking short term or long term? I mean, long term, look, if we're still talking about the elitism of the food movement in 20 or 30 years, that will be devastating. I don't think it is devastating now. I mean, a great many movements start out as elite movements. You look at women's suffrage, you look at abolition, you look at the environmental movement. These began with people who had time and money to spare. And over time, these movements spread, and they extended their benefits to everybody. I would hope that the same will be true for the food movement. And people are working very hard in this movement to do exactly that. I mean, one of the most exciting parts of the movement is urban agriculture and the community food security part of this movement, which is all about bringing fresh food to the food deserts in the inner cities, growing food there. You know, Will Allen's project in Milwaukee, where he's growing, you know, large amounts of food and giving lots of people jobs in really underserved neighborhoods. So I think that we are seeing progress on this. Some of the products will get cheaper. Take grass-fed beef, right? It's a really high-quality product. People are getting better and better at it. But it's still very expensive. And one of the reasons it's expensive is because of the economies of scale are not there. The small slaughterhouses that are serving those ranchers simply do not process enough meat to make it cheap. Whereas you've got the big four meat packers, they're doing 400 animals an hour. You know, they can take a cow and reduce it to a box of steaks for $50.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas your small, really good slaughterhouse, it costs them probably $150 to do the same thing. So that is keeping the price up. What that suggests, though, is as that market gets bigger for grass-fed beef, the price will come down. So will it ever get to the same point? No. Should it get to the same point? No. Because that cheap beef is a false economy. It costs in terms of public health, it costs in terms of the environment, it costs in terms of subsidies. So, I don't think our goal should be to make all food in America as cheap food is now.
Mm-hmm.
That's really freeloading food. It's not really cheap food. It's food that we don't pay the real cost of. The challenge, I think, is to give people the ability to afford better food. It's too much to ask the food movement to solve the whole problem of affordability in our society. If the goal is cheap food, we're gonna hurt our farmers, we're gonna hurt the environment, we're gonna hurt the public health. The goal should be to give people the money so they can afford to buy good food. We're in this kind of reverse Fordism situation. You know,
mm-hmm.
Fordism was this idea that Henry Ford said, well, I'm going to pay my workers enough so they can afford to buy my cars.
Right.
Okay, it raised
right.
everybody's boats. This was the social compact in America, an economic compact, up until the 70s, and then it collapses. We have the opposite. It's kind of the Walmart model, which is we're going to pay you so little you could only afford to buy our crummy food. And that's the kind of cycle we're in.
Interesting.
So, I think that the answer is to give people the buying power. We're only spending 9.5% of our money on food in this country. And we can't eat well on those kind of numbers.
So empower everyone across the board.
Yeah. And that's a big project. There's no question about it. But in the meantime, I think you will see this artisanal food, which is also driven up. The prices are driven up by the high demand for it because
mm-hmm.
so many people want this food now. I think the prices will come down and the differential will be less. And the government obviously can do a lot to help make this food more accessible by changing the subsidy system. Right now, we subsidize these really unhealthy calories, hydrogenated soy oil, corn syrup. The reason that the unhealthy calories in the supermarket are the cheapest calories is because those are the ones we subsidize. Well, what if we were doing something for the people growing produce?
Yeah.
That, I think, would level the playing field.
Michael Pollan, thanks for talking with us.
Good to be here, Lynn. Thank you.
Michael Pollan is the Knight Professor of Journalism at Berkeley and author of In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto. When we plot out road trips, tracking local treats, we're all over the burgers and the barbecues and the soda fountains, but we miss the boat on the great American standby, the potato chip. Now, in the hazy yesteryear of mom-and-pop fry-ups, local potato chips were as individual as the people who made them. Writer Dirk Berhens grew up in the heart of that potato chip country. He's written Crunch, A History of the Great American Potato Chip. Dirk, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn. Glad to be here.
So, Dirk, how did the potato chip start?
Well, there are many creation myths around the start of the potato chip. But the best documented story we have is that a woman named Katie Wicks in a restaurant called Moon's Lake House in Saratoga Springs, New York, was cooking crullers side by side with fried potatoes. Mm-hmm. And as she was peeling the potatoes, some of the potato peels accidentally got into the cruller oil. And she fished them out, and her brother, named George Crumb, tasted them. And Crumb was the chef, and he said, these are good. We'll be having plenty of these. And they started serving them on nightly in paper cornucopias on the table.
Like the expensive bistros do now.
I guess so, yeah. When you come to sit down at your table, they would bring you a cornucopia of potato chips. And that was 1853, so that's before the Civil War.
Right. So you must have tasted a ton of potato chips in doing this.
Oh, yeah.
What were the standouts?
Well, You know, I think that most Americans tend to think a potato chip is a potato chip is a potato chip.
And right. Yeah. They're good, but they taste about the same.
Yeah. And it's really not true. And one of the things that's so interesting to me is that there's so much cultural and local diversity in potato chip recipes and tastes. You can go to certain parts of Ohio today. It's kind of a swath from northwestern through southeastern Ohio where they cook potato chips in partially hydrogenated soybean oil. Well, what's that? Well, that's basically soybean oil that's high in trans fats. It's mm-hmm. probably not mm-hmm. real good for you.
Right.
But it's a very mild oil, and it results in a potato chip where you really get this essence of the potato. It's a light, white, fluffy, cloud-like potato chip. And there's a couple of companies there. There's one called Ballreich, Ballreich, and another called Conn's, Conn's.
Uh-huh.
And they both make this light, white, fluffy potato chip that really tastes potatoey. You really get this organic sort of roots and tubers taste that you don't get with other potato chips. And to most of us who haven't tried it, we'd be a little taken aback at first, but they're really great, and the people there swear by them.
What about lard? Is anybody still using lard, and does it make a difference?
Oh, yes. Lard makes a huge difference. If you go to Lancaster and York Counties, Pennsylvania, there are a few small mom-and-pop chip companies in those counties that still cook in lard. Their distribution radius is only a few counties. These are very small companies. Mm-hmm. And some of them cook a kettle chip. Those are those thick, crunchy chips that are so popular nowadays in lard.
Right.
That's a traditional type of potato chip. But a couple of them also make a thin picnic-style chip that's cooked in lard. And I'll tell you what, you just can't beat it.
What are the names?
The one that's my favorite is Goods, G-O-O-D, apostrophe S. It's aptly named because they make a good potato chip.
Right,
it's
right.
Formerly two companies, one of which is the oldest extant potato chip company in the United States, dating back to 1886. And they make a kettle lard chip and a continuously cooked thin lard chip. And another is called Gibbles, and they're both from Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And most of these companies have a web presence, and there's also a website called anchorsfoodfinds.com,
right,
where a lot of these chips can be ordered or linked to.
Is there any mass sort of distributed potato chip that stands out for you?
Yes, there's a couple. Cape Cod was the first of what I like to call the microbrew potato chippers that have come along in the past 10, 15, 20 years. It's very much like the microbrew beers, where there was this kind of turnover in the industry and a different kind of appeal. And Cape Cod is the first, and they're now distributed in all 50 states. They make a great kettle chip. And the other one is by a company called Kettle Brand that started out in the Pacific Northwest. And Kettle Brand chips are available in the natural food section of your grocery store or in natural food stores. Their regular plain salted chip comes in a brown bag, and they use russet potatoes, which are very hard to work with because they have a high sugar content. But I'll tell you what, Kettle Brand makes a terrific kettle chip.
I see a lineup of potato chips for tasting. What a sacrifice. Dirk, thank you. Thank you for talking with us.
You're very welcome, Lynn. Thank you.
Potato chips, how my mouth just drips. Potato chips, how my mouth just drips. Crunch, crunch, I don't want no lunch. All I want is potato chips. Potato chips.
Writer and editor Dirk Berhens is the author of Crunch, A History of the Great American Potato Chip. Now, for Dirk's potato chip picks, go to the website, splendidtable.org. The lines are open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Let's see. We have Jeff on the line from Columbus. Hey, Jeff, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about making pastrami.
ambitious.
Yes. Well, I'm from the New York area. I was raised on the famous like Katz's and Second Avenue deli pastrami's, and now I'm living in exile in the Midwest, and I'm trying to give it a go.
Okay. I've
been doing a whole bunch of reading on it, and I think I understand the brine curing process and the smoking.
Okay.
But when it comes to the stage where you coat the cured brisket in the spice mixture, I have no idea. So what I really want to know is, A, what should the mixture include?
Right.
B, how do I get it to stick to the meat? And most importantly, do I apply it before or after I smoke it?
Okay, these are educated guesses, all right?
Okay.
Because I've done my own corned beef. I've never done my own pastrami.
Okay.
Although the cure, from what I understand, is really similar. Mm-hmm. I think coarse ground black pepper, crushed coriander seed, and crushed mustard seed.
Okay.
Educated guess, that's all. But what I would do with all of those things is lightly toast them in a skillet, maybe 3 or 4 minutes until they're aromatic. You don't want to burn them.
Uh-huh.
But you want to get all of that toastiness out of them that you can.
Right.
And then I would put them on before you do the smoking, and I just would press them in to the meat. Nothing like that ever stays on. And I would probably have some clean stuff that's never been exposed to the raw meat, okay, to press in after you're done smoking. But I just would love to take a chance that smoking the meat with that on it is going to just give it, you know, a little bit more permeation. And then I would coat it again after I take, you know, I'm done with smoking it.
Wonderful. And a sort of a follow-up question, how do I achieve that Katz's delicatessen effect of having a pastrami that's so tender that it just kind of falls apart in your mouth?
Very, very, very slow heating. And I think the smoking now you're doing it with hot smoking, right? You're actually cooking it in the smoking process.
Yes.
Do that slowly. The safe temperature for anything like this is about 150 degrees interior temperature. Not a lot higher. This is one of the mistakes a lot of people make in this. They make it, they take it to 180 or whatever, and that's going to make it tougher. But the other thing is, do this with gentle heat. Do this, you know, don't if you can control the temp at all in your smoking process, keep the temp around 200 degrees or so, 250.
Okay.
Maybe, so that 250 is safer. You don't want us to go 200. That's a little too long of exposing it to a dangerous temperature. But about 250, 225. So you slowly cook it. And, of course, the other great thing about it is you got to have a lot of fat.
Right.
So you've got to use, you know, I think it's the breast of the beef that's used to make pastrami. And it's always has a generous amount of fat. And lean pastrami, forget it. Why bother?
Right.
You know, I've never understood that business of ordering it lean anyway. But the idea is that fat is also going to be the thing that's going to keep it juicy and really, really tender.
I've read on various websites and in various books, some people recommend an expensive mustard as a kind of adhesive.
Yeah.
And some people have said interesting things about molasses, which seemingly, well, does
I don't
that
know.
Make sense?
I don't remember sweetness with pastrami. Do you? I mean,
right. No, me neither.
I mean, yeah, you could use it, and yes, the mustard probably would never hurt, but I don't think you need an expensive one.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you so much.
Hey, you know, will you email us or let us know how it works?
Sure, I'll send pictures.
Because if the guess works, I'm going to take a shot at it. And by the way, just because it's obvious you're into this, there's a great book that came out a couple of years ago called Charcuterie, and I think they've even got pastrami in it. It is probably the best book we've seen so far on curing and preserving meat, especially pork and beef. Take a look at it. You'll love it. Michael Ruhlman is one of the authors. Take care.
Thanks so much.
Hey, thank you, Jeff. Bye. Okay, it is time for the weekly trivia challenge. And the question is, which dishes from chain restaurants won the 2009 Extreme Eating Awards handed out by those party poopers, the Center for Science and the Public Interest? Now, we're going to be back with that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be back to your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, which dishes from chain restaurants won the 2009 Extreme Eating Awards handed out by those party poopers at the Center for Science in the Public Interest? Well, the June 2009 announcement of the winners included most of the obvious suspects of chain eateries, but some of the dishes were doozies. As you hear these numbers, remember that the average person should eat 2,000 calories a day, no more than 20 grams of saturated fat, and 1,500 milligrams of sodium. My pick of the winners was an appetizer, that is, something designed to eat before your meal. It was Chili's Big Mouth Bites, 4 mini bacon cheeseburgers with fries and onion rings, and lest we forget, jalapeno ranch dressing dip. Now, one of these baby burgers is equal to starting a dinner with a quarter pounder. The whole plate has 2,350 calories, 38 grams, or that is about 2 days' worth of saturated fat, and 3,940 milligrams of sodium, 2.5 days' worth of salt. Another stunner was the Cheesecake Factory's chicken and biscuits. At 2,500 calories, this one plate beats out, are you ready for this, an 8-piece bucket of KFC fried chicken with 5 biscuits. The joys of eating out. Okay, back to the phones and your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see. We have Amy calling from Portland, Oregon. Amy, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I have been making jam for years. I love it here. We've got so much fresh, beautiful fruit.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
And I've done some unusual things, right, unusual combinations. And then 2 years ago, I got a hold of some food-grade lavender, and I made blueberry lavender jam.
Oh, that sounds pretty interesting.
It was really good. This year, I did some strawberry balsamic black pepper, and it's really great. And I want to know what other flavor combinations I could do with herbs or with vinegars or peppers and the different fruits we have here. Some people balk at it. I mean, my boyfriend was like, how about fish sauce? But I think he was being cheeky.
I don't know. I mean, I think fish sauce is pretty swell in certain things, but I don't think I want it in jam.
Thank you.
Let me think for a minute. Well, you know, there are certain, you know, there's a business about alcohol releases certain flavors that other mediums don't. Okay. You know, there are certain flavors that are soluble in water, and there are certain flavors that are soluble in fat, and alcohol evidently, all those flavors are soluble in alcohol, which is one of the reasons you see it used. And this brings to mind, are raspberries coming in at this point?
Oh, we've got beautiful raspberries right now.
Okay. There is a liqueur out there, and it's called Crème de Cassis.
Uh-huh.
And this creme de cassis, which is made in France, is only it's like 40% alcohol or less, and it's a rich, beautiful, dark purpley red, and it tastes like fruit. That with raspberries added toward the end of cooking the raspberries,
okay,
so that you get that flavor. That just sings. It is fabulous. And by the way, if you get your hands on a bottle, take some sparkling wine coming from your local neighborhood out there,
yes,
and put a few drops of this in, and you have a cassis, essentially, cocktail.
Oh, something to drink while I'm making it.
Yeah, it's called a cassis royale, and it's just dynamite. It's an old-time drink from the Burgundian area, and it's just fabulous. But that's one thing. Okay, think about creme de cassis with berries, but cherries and raspberries, fabulous with it. You know, blueberries and red wine.
Mm.
I'm going back to the alcohol thing, but that you could cook the blueberries in with the sugar and the whole thing and the red wine. Let the alcohol evaporate off, but that red wine is going to add a beautiful depth. And if you throw in there allspice and some of that black pepper that you would use with the strawberries, that would really be fabulous with the red wine. And
wow.
then You know, the other thing that's wonderful with especially things like blueberries and raspberries, vanilla beans.
Okay.
I used to puree raspberries with whole vanilla beans and then sieve it so that any bits of the vanilla bean and the seeds of the raspberry would, you know, disappear. And
right.
then that puree I would freeze in an Italian meringue with whipped cream. But the point is that that vanilla does such an incredible – it's like it explodes the flavors of the berries. And it is not shabby with nectarines or peaches either.
Wow. All
yeah.
right. So I don't have to split the vanilla bean and get the insides out? I just...
Yeah. Split it down the middle. Cook
okay.
a couple of them in with the fruit, and then you can pull them, or if you cut them in short pieces, they can go into the jar. You know, what's so bad about running into a piece of vanilla bean? You know, so you take it out of the jam and you suck on it and it tastes fabulous.
Oh, sounds great.
What could be bad?
Thank you so much, Lynn.
You are welcome. Enjoy the jam making.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
You can call us 800-537-5252. Remember the trick. Alcohol and fruit. Not a lot of alcohol, but alcohol and fruit, it just kind of kicks up the flavors. 800-537-5252. Who is waiting patiently? We have got Caleb calling from Queen Creek, Arizona. Caleb, what do you want to talk about?
Hi. I have a question about cheese.
Uh-huh.
Specifically Indian cheese. I don't know if it would necessarily be an Indian cheese.
As in India or Indian as
yeah,
in Native?
India, as in India, yeah.
Oh, okay.
As in Asian. There's a buffet in Mesa, Arizona. I'll give them a little plug real quick. They have some of the best Indian food on their buffet.
Uh-huh.
I have a friend that spent a lot of time in Pakistan and the Middle East during the war, and he said it's as good as any food he ever had there. But they have a dessert on there that I've never seen. It's a carrot dessert.
Yeah.
And the ingredients that I could figure out were shredded carrots, brown sugar, butter, and cheese. It's just amazing. And I asked if the chef would give up the recipe for
yeah.
it, and she said he wouldn't. And I kind of told her, I said, you know, I know this stuff, and I said, but what's the white stuff? And she said, that's cheese, but she didn't know what kind, and she said he made it himself.
Yeah, this is I can tell you what the cheese is because it's pretty popular in India, and you see it a lot in Indian recipes. The cheese is called paneer, and it's made the way more or less you would make ricotta. In so many words, milk is heated gently with vinegar. You know, with an acid, which separates the curds and the whey.
I have done a curds and whey before in culinary school, and I kind of had a feeling that might be along the same lines.
Yeah. Are you a chef?
No. I wanted to be since I was 13, and I went for 6 months and realized it wasn't what I wanted to do for a living. I just like working outdoors too much. So I'm a landscaper.
Hey, that's great. That's great. You know what? Thank goodness you found out and didn't make your life into something
you
would have.
I get to cook for fun. So.
Yeah, that's much better to cook for fun. But paneer ends up tasting like a farmer's cheese or like a drier ricotta. If you pressed a fair amount of the moisture out of a ricotta by, you know, putting it in a muslin bag or in a piece of cheesecloth and hanging it over something and just letting it drain, you would get something like paneer. It's sort of a creamy, semi-firm cheese, and the more you drain it, the firmer it gets.
So it doesn't have any kind of culture in it or anything?
No, it's the vinegar. I mean, to my knowledge, it's mainly some kind of acid. I've seen it made with mainly vinegar, but I've also seen it made with lime and lemon. Take the milk, and you should use whole milk here. And if you want it really rich, you can add cream to that. You know, so let's say just for argument's sake, you'd have for about a pound of cheese, you'd want about a quart of milk maybe, or half a pound of cheese, a quart of milk. Let's say you did 3 cups of whole milk and 1 cup of heavy cream, and then you'd add maybe 3-4 tablespoons of some kind of vinegar or lemon juice, and you'd heat that very gently. Use an instant reading thermometer. Heat it to about 180 degrees. This is the way I make ricotta. And you heat it slowly. Okay, and it's going to look like carnations are floating in liquid. You know, that's the curd firming up. And you get that curd, the more you cook it, you don't want it ever to boil, but the longer it's in that heat, it's going to get firmer. And then you drain that. You just lift that out, and then you can drain that in a cheesecloth or whatever. And as I said, the more moisture, the firmer it gets. But, I mean, I'm not sure if that's exactly the way it's done in India, but it's similar. So that gives you the cheese. And this is what I'm wondering. I've never run into the exact dessert that you're describing. Is the texture of it like a cheesecake or like a thick pudding?
No, it's actually more like a salad. You know, you've had a carrot raisin salad.
Yeah.
It's more like the texture of that. It's just served hot. It's one of the best desserts I've ever had.
Is the cheese in pieces?
It's a little tiny specks. That's why it does look like it. I hadn't really thought about that. I could not figure out what it was for anything. And when she said that, I started thinking curds and whey.
Yeah. This is what I would do. There is a dessert you're going to find in a lot of Indian cookbooks. It's essentially like a carrot pudding, where carrot is cooked with milk for like almost 2 hours until, and you can't scorch it. But the idea is it's cooked and cooked until the carrots are like a pudding. And then cream or condensed milk is added to that and sugar to taste, and then fried almonds or fried pistachios. I would bet you that he has taken that inspiration from that dessert. Now, were the carrots and the things fresh?
They're just fresh shredded carrots.
I would make the paneer. I would break it up. I would toss it with the shredded carrots and whatever else you saw in that mix, and sweeten it to however sweet it was when you tasted it. I think that's the whole deal.
All right, great.
Hey, thank you, sir.
And
have fun making this. This sounds like it's going to be delicious.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. You can call us. We can talk to you, and you can talk to us. 800-537-5252. If you're lucky enough to live in a city like Portland, Oregon, where the lunch truck is a protected species, you know how you can eat well in a dozen languages and get change back on a 10. Well, recently the lunch truck took another leap. As high-end chefs saw their bottom lines nosedive, some got over themselves and opened lunch trucks. Reporter Katie McLaughlin got the story for the Wall Street Journal. She called it Food Truck Nation. Katie, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
So I've got this image. We've got star chefs hawking on street corners. Now, who's doing this?
Well, I have been really surprised, but we are living in strange times, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I've seen restaurants and restaurateurs and chefs really scramble to come up with ways to survive this economy, which is brutal for high-end restaurants. And so you see a few different kinds of people taking this opportunity to get into this trend. One is the restaurateur, the young, ambitious chef or person who really wants to get started in this business. And what I've heard from several people in different cities is that they went out last summer and at the beginning of the fall, the fateful fall, and they wanted to raise money for their first restaurant, and they just found a brick wall there. It's always been hard to raise money for restaurants. Of course, restaurants are a risky business. And instead of giving up, they decided to do a truck or a cart. And I think what happened there is that there was a stigma there. It was there for many years, and it's fallen away. It's made this an acceptable choice. So that's one category of people getting into this business. But what really surprised me was seeing these high-end guys. I mean, people who have successful high-end restaurants. They see this as a way to make up for lost revenue.
And is it working for them?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Can you name some names?
There's a restaurant in Austin, Texas called Hudson's on the Bend. It's a long-time, well-respected, high-end restaurant, very expensive, $75 and up per person charge.
Mm-hmm.
And the chef, Jeff Blank, he has a dish that he's had for many, many years in the flagship restaurant, which is a flavorful coating that he puts on trout, and he sells it for, I don't know, tons of money in his restaurant. He decided to coat avocados, shrimp, and chicken with this special spicy coating, and they put this truck out there on the street. It's called the Mighty Cone. Huge hit. big hit. It's more than made up for his 25% drop off in revenue, he said.
What kind of money are we seeing here? I mean, what are some of the figures you've heard that people are making?
The money they can make?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I have a great example. These numbers actually stopped me in my tracks. There is a guy in the San Francisco Bay Area. His business is called Roly Roti. He does high-end rotisserie. He uses very good meats, you know, heritage pork, local lamb, that kind of thing. He invested $150,000 each in three trucks that he has. He said last year he grossed $1.6 million. Those numbers are very interesting for the Bay Area, where it's real expensive to start a restaurant.
Yeah, yeah.
But if they have the restaurant, and then that's like the hub, and then the trucks feed out from that. And that is a business model that some of these players are looking at as one that will really work financially.
Well, from the diner's point of view, this offers just another whole collection of choices. It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Hey, Katie, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Katie McLaughlin reviews restaurants and writes about food for the Wall Street Journal. Her article, Food Truck Nation, appeared in the June 5th, 2009 issue. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Ferdinand Poix. It was about sizing up the food of a chef. He said, if the chef is thin, I will probably dine poorly. If he's both thin and sad, the only hope is flight. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. You can meet people who love food at food.gather.com. You'll find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. And also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau and Jennifer Larson. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Brett Baldwin. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.